So I was in the main analytical laboratory for, I think, 6 months, something like that.
And what kind of work were you doing there?
Analytical work primarily on magnesium alloys. One incident, too, that was interesting to me, and it might be interesting to others. While I was in the main analytical laboratory analyzing magnesium alloys, I had a bottle of what was supposed to be sodium hydroxide. And it was labeled, it was a Baker label on it. At least I don't know where how it got contaminated. But anyhow, it turned out to be sodium cyanide rather than sodium hydroxide. And I found that out in my work and in my analysis of, it just didn't work, of course, the same way the caustic did. But anyway, I did find it out, and I think maybe that had something to do with my first initial notice at the Dow Chemical Company that I was, here was somebody who was curious and was observant and that sort of a thing, because I did find this out, and I did notice it, and I didn't get myself killed with cyanide.
Do you remember the analytical procedures you were following? I read somewhere you were doing six elements. It took about a week to do the...
Yes, yes. And I don't even remember what they were, but there was manganese in the magnesium and aluminum in the magnesium and iron. I don't remember what the others were. But there were about six different elements that we were analyzing for. And then I did other analytical work, too, that the sample grabber would bring in samples from the plant, and we'd have to run them in the daytime, or sometimes I worked nights, and he would bring them in, and that was a hurry-up job. You had to do that right now because he had to call the plant back.
Yeah, I see.
But I don't remember what they were, what the procedures were.
Can you tell me something about H.H. Dow in those early you didn't go through that student training program. That came after.
No, that came afterward.
Right.
So I didn't go. But Herbert Dow, of course, he was a Case graduate, and he was interested in Case graduates. And early in the history of the Dow Chemical Company, practically everybody he hired was from Case.
I see.
This was very, very usual for him to do that. And so he was I can't think how to describe him concisely. He was a very conservation-minded man. I remember one little story about him, that this was when Grebe was with him, and Grebe told me the story, really. But they were walking out of the hotel room in Cleveland when John was with H.H. Dow, and they were giving this talk on the high-boiling organic compounds. But John was behind H.H. Dow as they walked out the hotel door, and John forgot to turn off the lights. And Herbert Dow turned around and turned off the lights, and then he gave John a lecture of about 5 minutes of the poor miners who had worked to make the coal, to make the power, and here John was wasting it. So he was a very, very conservation-minded individual, and he was perhaps almost as much interested in the power, generation of power, as he was in the chemistry. Mm. He was very, very much interested in it. And basically, the Dow Chemical Company, up until a few years ago at least, has always been very, very power generation minded. Mm. And they've generated their own power for their electrolytic processes. But other than that, and the fact that well, here's another little story. The old bromine plant was right next to the main office, and Herbert Dow, he visited every plant at that time in Midland every week. Once a week, he'd get through LLM, and this bromine plant, the old bromine plant, was right near the office. So the manager, Glenn Cantwell, of the bromine plant, saw Herbert Dow come out, and he knew he was going to go through his plant first. And he didn't have time to arrange anything, except he walked in to the lunchroom, which he knew Herbert Dow would have to come through to get to the rest of the plant. And all he had time to do was to arrange all the lunch pails in a nice military fashion. And sure enough, the next day, Glenn Cantwell got a note from Herbert Dow complimenting him on the fact that his lunchroom was in such good order and all the dinner pails were lined up in such military fashion. But he noticed things like that, and I guess the important thing that I wanted to make, point I wanted to make, was that he visited every laboratory and every plant at least once a week, all through the middle of course, it wasn't a big plant at that time. There were only about 1,500 employees, something like that. So it wasn't a huge plant. But nevertheless, he did get out, and he did see it, and he did know all of us. And he had another thing that he did, which I think was pointed out some of his character. Saturday mornings, we work Saturday, incidentally, Saturday mornings, with a 4 to 5 hour week. But he would, new employees, he would schedule a trip through the plant. And he would personally take all the new employees, which may have been only 3 or 2 or 5 or 6 or something like that, but he'd take us all through the whole plant from one end to the other, explain what was going on, what was happening, and he did this over and over again, Saturday after Saturday.
Sounds like the forerunner of that student training program.
It was a forerunner. I'm glad you mentioned that. It was. It certainly was.
And did he take a personal interest in you? Did he talk to you about what you were doing? Was the analyses you were doing in the lab? Did he talk to you about those at all?
He talked to me, but he talked to everybody, and not to me any more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Grebe, he did. Grebe, he always came in with a bunch of ideas, and he'd try them out on Grebe. This is another little story that I have in the first chapter, too, but I think it might be worth telling. But Herbert Dow had lots of ideas, and most of them were good ideas. And he'd come and talk to John about them. And one day, though, Herbert Dow came in, and I was sitting right next to we were all crowded in one little room. But he tried an idea out on John that I thought was a bit crazy, not up to Herbert Dow's usual standard of good ideas. But anyway, John was enthusiastic about it, and he said, well, he would look it up and he'd think about it, and he'd call him back in the morning and tell him about it. And so when Herbert Dow left, I said to John, what in the world made you so enthusiastic about this idea that to me seemed crazy? And John gave me a lecture. He gave me a 5-minute lecture. First of all, an idea is God's greatest gift to humanity. Without it, we'd still be in the Dark Ages. And on and on. And whenever you hear an idea, don't be negative about it. Be positive about it. Tomorrow's soon enough to be a judge. So try to do this. And I remember that all my life, and I've tried to do it all my life. But This was Grebe all over again, and if you want an introduction to John Grebe, that is the introduction to him. Enthusiasm plus ideas plus encouraging everybody to have ideas and not ever being negative about them when you first hear them.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You were in that analytical lab only a short time, or the main lab only a short time.
Yes.
Did you know before, when you went to Dow, that you'd end up in the physics lab?
No.
Okay.
Had no idea.
Did they tell you, John, when they offered you the job, did they tell you what they had in mind for you as a new technical employee?
No, not at all. Grebe borrowed me for 2 days to help him take data on a Dow therm, which was this high-boiling organic compound that was supposed to improve electrical generation. But he bored me for 2 days to help him take data. And I'm sure now, I didn't realize it then, but I'm sure now he did that to get to know me, mm-hmm, and to decide whether he wanted me. Well, the 2 days grew into 2 years, and the 2 years grew into almost 20, and so on and so forth. So that's how I moved from the main lab to John Grebe. And I was the only one in the lab at that. Well, I shouldn't quite say that. There were two lab assistants, and John had already introduced about, I think, 2 different automatic controls, or at least sensing devices. And these assistants technicians really were supposed to go around each day and check these and do that sort of thing. But I was the first professional graduate to work with Grebe.
And that occurred still in 1926, didn't it? That was late in the year of 20.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten when Grebe came to Dow, but it wasn't much.
1924.
When you were measuring those properties of Dow Therm, you said that Grebe had borrowed you. How long a project did that turn out to be, or was that just a short term?
It was such a short term. Actually, I took the data on the pilot plan. But then when we took the data, it was characteristic of Dow at that time to very early in a development to operate a pilot plant, build and operate a pilot plant, and then go back to the lab and work out any questions that turned up for it. So I was given the job of measuring the Pacific heat at a whole bunch of different temperatures and explosive limits and a few other things like that. And this took me perhaps most of the first year I worked for Dow. Oh, first year I worked for Grebe, 18 months worked for Dow. But this also explains a little bit more about Herbert Dow. John Grebe was sent to Germany. When he came to the United States, he came as an immigrant by himself and worked for his uncle in Cleveland. So during the during the period when I'm losing myself here.
Are you Dr. Burney?
Yes.
Oh, I was supposed to tell you too, my God.
Okay.
You're supposed to call. Turn back on. I was telling the story about Herbert Dow and John Grebe, and the fact that Grebe had left his entire family it was a large family in Germany, so he took a leave of absence about 6 months after I went to the physics lab to Germany to visit his family and to arrange to bring them back to the United States. But in the meantime, he left me with the problem of measuring the Pacific heat of Dow Therm at Dow phenyl oxide at different temperature ranges. And to do that, I needed a couple of resistance thermometers, which before John left, we had ordered from Leeds and Northup. And Herbert Dow called me about a week after John had left for Germany and said, how are you coming along with the Pacific heat measurements? He was that interested in things like that. And I told him, well, we had ordered these thermometers, these resistance thermometers, and we hadn't heard from them in about 10 days. And Herbert Dow said, well, 10 days is much too long to wait for something like that. He said, you get on the phone and call them and find out when they're going to ship it. This, believe it or not, this is the first time I had ever had an occasion to use a long-distance telephone. Remember, this was 1926. But I went to the Pershing Department and got permission to talk. I knew enough to do that, to talk to Leeds and Northup, and they gave me the number to call. I called the number, and when Herbert Dow called first thing next morning to find out what had happened, I was able to tell him, well, they were shipped and they were on the way and we'd have them soon. But he was that interested in everything that was going on.
That's amazing, because in an operation that size...
Yes, he'd have so much to do.
What kind of a person was Grebe to work for at the beginning when you started with him in the lab?
Very easy. He gave you all kinds of what I call accountable freedom, not just freedom to go do your time or waste or anything else, but what he called accountable freedom. And if you had that and you were working on something of interest to the Dow Chemical Company, even though it was for something which might be good 10, 20 years from now, he encouraged it. He just simply encouraged it, and he was enthusiastic, and he, in order to encourage people to do more of it, he originated what he called the idea card system. And everybody in the lab, these cards were available, so everybody had the cards. And if you had an idea, no matter how wild it was, you filled in the card, you dated it, made it a record, and then this is the most interesting thing. You posted it on the bulletin board, which he had made especially for this, for everybody to see, for everybody to make suggestions to help you out or to improve it or to do something with it. So this was his idea card system, and it's so characteristic of John Grebe that I took the time to mention it.
I had not heard about that before. That's interesting.
It's a very interesting thing, and I don't know of any place else that's ever been used either. It must have been, but this was my only contact with it.
Now, would he follow up on those two? And would he, when you didn't give them to him to post, you posted them directly on the board?
Yes. Anybody who had an idea posted them directly on the board.
Right.
Without giving them to him, he would look at the board every day and see what was new and what was going on. And he always encouraged ideas. And if you were discouraged and you couldn't make it work, he had 16 more ideas of how to make it work. So he was so easy to talk to and so enthusiastic about everything that everybody talked with him, everybody liked him. Everybody in the lab liked him. I guess we had competition in some of the other labs that wasn't that quite that way. But
I was going to ask you whether you had any kind of regular meetings, but to discuss what you were doing within the lab.
We did have regular meetings. We had once a month. We had what he called a seminar, where he encouraged everybody to come. Herbert Dow, Willard Dow used to come to some of these meetings when we review in writing. These were written reports at that time. And then every other month we'd have oral reports, which were just exclusively for the lab personnel themselves, and they could exchange ideas and talk about them or make fun of them or anything else they wanted to. But the formal meetings every other month were for the plant production people and for other research heads, and for Dr. Dow and Willard Dow, if they wanted to come. But we did have these formal meetings as well as the informal ones.
Now, very early, you did some work in, I also have a note here that you worked on the distillation of tetraethyl lead. You did one of those for Britton?
Dr. Britton in the organic lab, he also bored me before John had bored me. He bored me for a few days to help him out on the distillation of tetraethyl lead, which he was doing some work for DuPont at that time. And I was there busy at the desk running a distillation of tetraethyl lead and some other things, which Dr. Britton had told me how to do and what to do and how to set it up and everything. But I was sitting right close to the distillation flask, and Dr. Britton came along and he said, "Well, this material has been known to explode, so maybe you better stand back a few feet." And he hadn't walked 15 feet away when, boom, the whole thing went up. Everybody in the lab had to evacuate. Nobody was hurt. But the white fumes filled the lab, and of course it was tetraethyl lead, and it was poisonous. Everybody got out of the lab, and they had to stay out for a half a day. And that was the next day where Dr. Britton sent me back to the main lab. That was my experience as an organic chemist.
Was this a common way of doing that? They would come into the main lab and pull people out?
I've learned much later that was a very common way. I did not realize it at the time.
And this is how they determined which ones they wanted to move into their
exactly,
group.
Exactly. It was rather a good system.
Very early, when did you start working on the bromine? I guess that was a little later, wasn't it?
A little later, but not very much. There weren't many in the lab. There were probably a dozen in the lab by that time. See what a bromine.
Can you tell me something about your experiences with that?
Yes. John Grebe came to me and said that the DuPont were very much interested in large quantities of bromine, much larger than Dow had already agreed to double the number of brine wells they had in order to make bromine for tetraethyl lead. But for ethylene dibromide, for in use with ethyl fluid. But at the same time, they knew, DuPont knew, and Dow knew too, that they couldn't possibly get this much bromine from the brine wells. It was too expensive to do it that way. So DuPont was interested in making bromine from seawater, and they had already devised a system which used aniline, and they added aniline. They freed the bromine, added aniline to make tribromaniline, which was an insoluble material, filtered it, and either used that then, they planned to either use that as an additive rather than the ethylene dibromide, or else to free the bromine and then make ethylene dibromide from it. And they had outfitted a ship, which they called the Good Ship Ethel, and taken it out into the ocean, but it was expensive and the tribromaniline was difficult to filter and the losses were very high, so it was a failure. And so then they came to Dow and said, how about making bromine? And H.H. Dow got interested right away quick in making it from seawater. So the group who were, Barstow's group in the Dow Chemical Company, were responsible for the bromine work. So they were working on the bromine, but they couldn't, for some reason or other, they weren't able to free the bromine in the ocean. It just didn't work. They got a little bromine and then it disappeared. And so John Grebe came to me and said, well, look, what they're forgetting about is that there's a little bit of alkalinity in the ocean. It's probably sodium carbonate or bicarbonate. And you have to acidify this first before you can possibly free the bromine. Otherwise, it'll make sodium bromate. You'll never even see it. And it won't be volatile. So he said, run a titration curve on ocean water and see what it looks like. And I did, and sure enough, there was at a pH of about 7 or 6, maybe it was, and then you titrated it with acid, with 10th acid, and then it went up down to 3. So John said, acidify it to a pH of 3 and then chlorinate it and see if you can free the bromine. Well, sure enough, first you get a flash of iodine, and then you get the bromine color. And that's all there was to it, and that was John's invention. And then the method of controlling the acidity and the method of then controlling the chlorination, too, to control so you get good efficiency. But that was the contribution of the physics lab to the seawater bromine process.
And this is what those controls then are what you use for your master's thesis?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Actually, my master's thesis was on the theory of automatic control,
okay,
starting with damping control and anticipatory control and all those sorts of things. But that's also was Grebe's interest at that time was very much, and Herbert Dow's interest was very much in that.
How long did that take to work out? What period of time?
Maybe 3 months.
3 months.
Our contribution. And then, of course, after that, after the plant was built, the physics lab people went down and worked in the plant, actually put in the instruments and the controls and stayed there to operate it. And then a little later in the seawater bromine process, a chap by the name of George Hooker came up with the conventional method of first you blow the bromine out with air. And then you react in another tower, absorption tower, you react it with sodium carbonate, to make sodium bromide. And then you free the sodium bromide with more chlorine to get the bromine concentrated. Well, George Hooker came up with the idea of he was a physics labber. He came up with the idea of burning sulfur to SO2, introducing that into the air, the blowing out air, with a very dilute bromine, making a combination of sulfuric acid, which you could then recycle back into to acidify the seawater, and HBr, which none of which were volatile, and this would drop out and would save one whole step in the process of regenerating the sodium bromate. So this was being done, and this also was a physics lab proposition, and we had physics lab people down when they built that plant and started. That was probably 2 or 3 years later, after the plant was a success.
Did You make any trips to the plant yourself?
Yes. Yes, I spent, in Wilmington, North Carolina, I spent maybe a month down there altogether. Different times. Mm-hmm. Checking the automatic controls.
When was that plant built then? What year was that?
Oh, just for a wild guess, I'd say 1932 or 3.
Okay.
Plus or minus about 3 years.
What was your next project after that?
Maybe sodium for an electrical conductor. Oh, first of all, we used the Dow Chemical Company used sodium as a reducing agent in the production of indigo dye, and the sodium was manufactured somewhere in the Niagara Falls by an outside company, and Dow bought it. But the price went up and up and up to where Herbert Dow decided that we could make it ourselves more economically than we could do it, than we could buy it. So he had, we designed and built a sodium cell using salt as a thing. But the difference was there's always a problem with a high temperature sodium cell, that the sodium is freed at the cathode, I think it was a cathode, and then it redissolves or backs up into the salt, mixture of salt, and you never can skim it off or get it all out. So John's idea was to have the cathode just touch the bath so that the temperature at the point where the sodium was produced was above the boiling point of sodium. So then we built a condenser above it, and theoretically at least, and we did, we made maybe 100 pounds of sodium altogether that way. But in the meantime, this company that was furnishing sodium heard about all of this, and they lowered the price down to where it was no longer economical. Well, then the next problem was this got Herbert Dow interested, and so he thought, well, why use all this good copper for electrical conductors when the ocean is full of ocean is full of sodium? So we worked on a high amperage sodium conductor, and the DC current was produced on one side of the river, and then across the bridge, the electrical line for the sodium cell, for the chlorine cells that were operating on the other side of the river. And so he said, well, why don't we just take a 2-inch pipe and fill it with sodium and put it across the bridge and use this as an electrical conductor for the high amperage current. Mm. And so we did, and we had all kinds of trouble with it and all kinds of problems. But nevertheless, we filled it about 3,000 feet of 2-inch pipe and mounted it and filled it up and used that as an electrical conductor. And of course, the problems were many. Mostly it was just getting good contact all the way through and filling the pipes. We were given scrap, well, they weren't really scrap. They were good 3- and 2-inch pipes, but they'd been used for brine before, and they were rusted a little bit, and the water underneath, the brine underneath, and so when we tried to fill the darn things with sodium, the sodium went woof, and it would blow out and we tried to fill 40-foot lengths at a time. And then we had, of course, the problem of connecting each 40-foot length, and that was not easy either. But nevertheless, we were able to dry the pipes, and we were able to make it and get it installed, and it operated, I guess, for about 2 or 3 years. And this was written up in an Electrochemical Society paper.